Hello and welcome to The Hill's Digital Health Innovation Podcast. The Hill is a digital health catalyst based at Oxford University Hospitals, managing innovation and bringing digital technology into the NHS. Here at The Hill, we're very passionate about needs-led innovation, and a big part of that is understanding the realities of health and care. This series will be bringing you a range of voices from the front line of clinical care, hearing about their daily work and what opportunities they see for innovation and improvement. Welcome. My name is Megan Morris-Carter, Director of Digital Innovation at Oxford University Hospitals, and I'm joined by James Gamble, Consultant Cardiologist at the John Radcliffe Hospital. Welcome, James, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you start off, James, by telling us a little bit about your job and what your day-to-day looks like?
Yes, sure. So I'm a cardiology consultant, so I do deal with hearts, and I do quite a mixture of things. Most cardiologists now are subspecialized, as we have things within cardiology that we particularly deal with. And for me, that's heart failure and then also some implantable devices, so pacemakers and related gadgetry.
And how did you end up where you are today?
I suppose I've sort of failed to leave in that I was a medical student here and have orbited Oxford since, really, and never quite managed to achieve escape velocity, which is perhaps not a bad thing. I trained here at Cambridge and here, and then have done most of my specialist training around here since.
And can you tell us a little bit more about heart failure as a disease? Because not everyone may understand exactly.
Yes, sure. I mean, unfortunately, it's one of those terms that you probably wouldn't choose if you redid it. Patients are terrified by the term. Often they hear failure and think, oh, I must be dying and everything must be stopping working immediately. And what it means is that heart's not doing as much as you ask of it. And I suppose that, you know, so it might mean that they're breathless when they're sitting still. And some people, it might just mean that they're breathless or feeling unwell when they try and walk up a hill or if they try and run up a hill. So the heart's not able to keep up with demands put on it. Lots of different things cause it. Most commonly, heart artery disease is still the most common cause, but lots of people have other causes as well. And we see a big mixture of that.
So there's lots and lots of different things that cause heart failure. It's not just one single disease.
No, I mean, it's almost defined as a syndrome. So it's a set of signs and symptoms that have various underlying causes, if that makes sense. So there's lots of different things behind it. The big issue with it really is it's a disease mostly of age and therefore increasing rapidly. I mean, I looked up the NHS, have quite useful statistics. So I think it's one in 35 people in their 60s. But by the time you get to 70s and 80s, it's up to one in 15 people. And people in their 80s and 90s, you're up to one in seven people. So extremely common. And as we see more and more older people and old people who have otherwise been healthy, this is quite a common thing that we get as people get older and as they get into their 80s and 90s, which of course is much, much more common now.
And can you tell us what the biggest challenges are facing the teams who are looking after people who have heart failure?
I think it's going back to what we just said, and it's really volume. I think we looked back at our number of hospital admissions with heart failure to Oxford University Hospitals, and it's going up by somewhere around 1% a month. So we're seeing slightly over 1% a month. So we're seeing somewhere between 15 and 20% increases per year and have for the last few years. So inevitably, that's very hard unless your staffing keeps up with that, which it almost inevitably doesn't. So you end up with increasing numbers of patients with this. And alongside that, I think complexity and multimorbidity, again, I think the average age of people admitted to the John Radcliffe with heart failure is 82 or 83. So this is a very old and very comorbid patient group. And again, colleagues in Oxford have looked at the comorbidity burden, and most people with heart failure have three or four at least other medical conditions. It's rarely on its own.
And presumably, there's quite a spectrum of different levels of acuity in terms of the heart failure, but also the other comorbid conditions.
So. Yes, absolutely. I mean, and there's a cohort of people in whom they're very, very unwell. Essentially, this is heart failure, perhaps as a prelude to the end of life, and that, you know, all sorts of bits of them are failing, and the heart is one of those. And of course, ultimately, the heart failing happens in everybody at one stage in their life, normally right at the end. So you see some of this in everybody. But yes, absolutely. So there's a group in whom this is part of sort of end-of-life multi-morbidity. There's groups in whom this may be their main disease, and you obviously end up treating those quite differently.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, and I know, James, when we spoke earlier, then you had some ideas about how to manage this difficulty of having a huge volume of patients with quite a range of different symptoms and different levels of acuity. What are your thoughts about how that could be better managed?
There definitely are specialist needs. Some bits of it can be quite challenging. Some of the patients are very, very complicated. But I can't see everybody in Oxfordshire with heart failure, and nor myself or my colleagues who are specialists in it can't. There's just too many people. So you have to end up with a sort of pyramid structure where you have a small number of very specialist people who in this are probably, a cardiologist with a particular interest in that. And then you are helping and guiding lots of other people in hospital. That might be, we have some specialist nurses, but then also other consultants who will be seeing this amongst lots of different pathologies. And it might be that I'll go and see a patient once, or one of our nurses will go and see a patient once and provide that advice and support them in looking after the patient. And then also mean that we can plug the patient into outpatient services to support that. And then similarly in an outpatient process, some of that is with guidance or with support of general practitioners who inevitably are managing most of this. And then again, we have a cohort of specialist nurses in the community who can help the general practitioners in adjusting the medications, in seeing the patients, and being a first point of contact really for those patients in whom this is a big part of their diseases.
So that's quite a complex picture.
Yes.
Definitely. A lot of different specialisms, a lot of different people who need to get involved with the care of these patients. I mean, how do you, as one of the specialists, support that very wide group of potentially more general practitioners or nurses or other practitioners within the group?
That has gone quite electronic now. It's a lot of email. And also we have regular virtual MDT. So rather than everyone being in a room together, and 5 or 6 years ago, we used to make everyone fight into Oxford through the traffic. And now we have an MDT on Teams. And actually that works very well. You can look at images if you want to, but mainly for the challenging patients or supporting the nurses. And so we have a mixture of a full MDT when you have the whole team and multiple consultants can discuss a case. And well, we call it supervision, which is probably rather old-fashioned, but what we mean by that is the nurses and a consultant can talk about tricky cases who we might not necessarily let everyone to be inputting in. So there's sort of, you have that layered approach, essentially, of depending on how tricky the case is and how complex and how many are the different people we need to get involved with that.
And also, I've obviously seen that in some parts of the hospital, we are now offering hospital-at-home services. We can do things like echoes at home, things like that. Does that form part of that sort of supervision, if you like, or that kind of being able to be next to the patient, even though you're in the hospital?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the echo at home is with some of the acute physicians who are doing that. And that's been very strongly supported by us as the heart failure team, in that we've moved, particularly actually in Oxford, to doing, if people have heart failure, very often what they need is diuretic. So medication that makes them pee more. And that often stops working as a tablet at a certain stage. If there's so much fluid around, they need it into the vein to work more effectively. And historically, that's meant quite long hospital stays, because you can only pee out so much more fluid in a day, maybe if you're really going for a litre extra. So if you've got 10 kilograms of fluid, then the math is quite straightforward. You're going to have 10 days in hospital. And actually, what we're doing on that, maybe once or twice in a day, you're giving them the diuretic. Otherwise, there's not that much happening. And some of these people are very ill and can't walk or can't cope at home. And then clearly they have no option from being in hospital. But actually, if this is the dominant problem, then staying at home can be much better. So that's something that led really by my medical colleagues in the ambulatory assessment unit and that team. We've taken a lot of the heart failure patients who would traditionally have been admitted and left them at home with a nurse going in once a day to give that intravenous diuretic. And then a remote oversight. And again, that's mostly in that sort of pyramid structure, so that they will be able to talk to a nurse. And if there are problems, they can come and find one of the consultants and ask about it. So you can manage a reasonably large number of patients in that mechanism without a small number of consultants having to get individually involved in all the detail for every patient, because you can't. the big thing you avoid is that sitting around in hospital and losing your independence and losing your strength because you've spent 2 weeks sitting in a hospital bed doing nothing. And that can be almost literally lethal for 80 and 90 year olds. So avoiding that is great. Of course, it comes with a change of costs. I was going to say reduction, mostly a reduction, because being at home is cheaper than being in hospital, but you still need staff to do that and that expertise to do it safely.
Yeah, because obviously the staff are then traveling out to the patient. So it's
exactly, yeah. So it's different. And it's interesting. I think, you know, what's interesting there is the change in management, because that's happened very fast on a, as it were, you'd say historic change. You know, you still have a stage where a lot of guidelines would say, well, you've got to definitely admit these people and you've got to treat them as an inpatient. And because the practice has been fast, it's probably ahead of practice in lots of other places, or and without, you know, not what people would say we do doing guidelines. We know it, we've shown it works, but it's pushing on a bit like that, I think, to say, we think this is the right thing to do. We think we can do it safely. And obviously we've got some of our own data to show that. It's being prepared to push ahead with those things, I suppose.
Do you see that technology has enabled that kind of activity, both the MDTs at sort of remotely, yeah, with people and also the hospital at home? And is there scope for more development in that area, do you think?
I think an electronic patient record is almost essential for that, because you, by its nature, it's not one patient in one place with one set of paper notes. So it would be very, very, very hard, I think, to manage that sort of system if you have a set of paper notes that you can only see if you are next to them. So the advantage, you know, because a nurse can be at home, can be administering the diuretics, can have a laptop or something and say, oh, well, this is what their blood pressure is normally. I'm not worried that when I've measured it today, it's quite low, because it's always like that. As an example. So I think you can't do that sort of care without electronic records and that model. We haven't used a huge amount of technology, and we haven't used sort of video links or those sort of technologies to support it. We've mostly just gone for old fashioned, as it were, telephone, which just generally worked reasonably well. And there's a risk that the more complicated you get, I suppose, the more friction you introduce, and you potentially, as you just, you can have fancy thing on top of that may not change what you would do. Although I suppose that you get information you just don't necessarily need or want to know.
Yes, yeah. So collecting data and then using data are two different things,
yes,
aren't they?
Definitely. Really? Yeah. In this patient group, I've often given an example of, people sometimes say, well, couldn't you measure their pulse at home? And there's a risk that you just get information that's either terrifying or you don't want to know. And if you show their pulse doing something horrendous at home when you know they're 20 minutes away from the nearest ambulance, it's not information you can act on. And it probably isn't going to change what you do, because it's either going to be too late or it makes no difference.
Yeah, so it's very important to get the right bits of information,
yes,
at the right time for the right people, I suppose.
Yes, definitely, and something that you can generally intervene on.
How about support for staff in general? So, you know, obviously using the MDT model, I think it's a fairly traditional way of doing medicine in many respects. Yeah. But do you feel that people have had to learn to work in different ways to manage patients that perhaps of higher acuity or where they wouldn't have managed them before?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think if you look at sort of that whole ambulatory care model, it's gone from nothing to a very, very major way of the hospital works over 3 or 4 years, really. So that I think people have had to change quite a lot and adapt to that. And of course, taking different risks. It's quite different being at for a nurse going to see the patient at home. That's very different to being in a hospital where you can press a call bell or go around the corner and find a doctor. If you're out on your own alone with a patient, it's a different challenge.
Yeah, it's a different level of responsibility.
It is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you feel like there's had to be a lot of training involved, or do you think it's been more about a culture change, or what do you think has been the key thing that's enabled that?
I think it's been more cultural, actually, interestingly. I think some of it had just been going for a model of saying, we think this is the right thing to do. We will make it happen. And you can I think if you're confident with that and you have a good system around it, then you take people with you for that. It's very hard to train people for something that's no one's really done before. So, because you can't, it's not as if you could, anyone who could say, well, this is how we do it. So I think essentially most people have been learning this as they go along and finding the right way to do that as as the system has evolved, essentially.
And what do you think is the key thing for driving that culture change?
I think it's having people, having leaders who want to make it happen, I suppose. Is if you've got that high level support to ensure that it happens, then you can make that happen. And some of that as well, I think, is having leaders or people in this team who have got that kind of can-do attitude to say, yes, we will make this happen. It may initially be a little uncertain, or we may be finding our way through it, but we're going to go for that anyway. So I think leadership is probably the thing there that facilitates this most, which is interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I think we've certainly seen that building the culture and capacity for innovation within the organization is just as important as progressing individual projects.
Sure.
Because I think it enables that innovation at all levels in the organization and in many, many different ways. So some of them being process changes, some of them being digital innovations, sometimes being something quite small, sometimes much larger transformations, but all of them require that culture change in a sense and that willingness to participate and to get involved.
Yes, I'm sure that's right. But giving it a go, as it were. Yeah.
Coming back to the heart failure for a moment, you've talked a little bit about management of patients who already have the condition. Is there any scope for preventative care as well?
There is, certainly. I mean, we've talked about heart artery disease being the major underlying risk factor still. So there's a lot of work that's been done for many years, really looking at preventative that and smoking, diet, obesity, diabetes, all of those big risk factors. There's always that disconnect between the hospital and community management with that. I mean, I have a role within Bob as well as a kind of cardiovascular lead there. And so I see both, which has been interesting because as a hospital clinician, you're very focused on the downstream stuff mostly, on the people who've already got the disease rather than on preventing it. And I've become more involved in the prevention. Of course, in some ways, it's more complex because you immediately, all of those things I just spoke about pretty much are both how likely you are to smoke, for example, and whether you can stop is hugely tied up in your social background, where you live, what your job is, what your family do, what family support you've got, what education you've got, and all of those things feed into that. And of course, the more complex you get that, the harder and harder it gets to be able to change those things in medicine. You get into politics basically very rapidly.
Yeah, preventative medicine is a huge area, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and lots of different factors, many of which the health service doesn't necessarily is not directly able to influence.
Yes, I think because, as I say, I think they're essentially politics. If that makes you're talking about where people live or what their lifestyle is or what social support they have, and it's hard for the health service directly to influence that.
Presumably that also feeds into how well patients can manage their own conditions at home.
Definitely. And I mean, one of the interesting things about medicine I've always thought is how you can have people with the same condition, they can have the same, you can measure how well their heart works and it can be 20% for one and 20% for another. And how that patient presents and copes with their disease is hugely variable. And again, that's psychology, that's family support, that's intelligence, that's ability to cope. All of those things feed into how somebody deals with their disease. And I'm sure that cuts across pretty much anything within medicine, really. You can support the patients as best we can do. But it can be hard to get around some of those factors sometimes. I mean, I think actually that's why, our model of having these community heart failure nurses can be fantastic, because you can support patients who can't manage by themselves to do that by giving them that extra personalized support, or who find it harder. There's a cohort of patients who will happily manage things themselves. There's a cohort who will do it, but need a lot of encouragement and support. And then there's perhaps a smaller cohort who just can't. However hard you try, they still can't do it. It's very, very hard to help that final group. We can try our best. But the middle ones, I think, is actually a good place to focus your input, because they're the people who you can improve a lot. And we know very well with this disease that if people can manage it well, if we can get them onto the right medications, then we keep them out of hospital and we keep them well.
So zooming out a little bit from the heart failure and the specifics of the innovations you've seen, I know we've talked a little bit about hospital at home and kind of the challenges of measuring what the impact of that service is. What do you think are the challenges for adoption of innovation and how do you think we should approach bringing new things into the health service?
So I think it's about making sure that what the innovation is, it is well targeted to the clinical service and to the need, because we do definitely see innovations where someone's had a nice idea and in theory it would help, but then when you put it up against reality, it doesn't actually make a difference. And I mean, in heart failure, people have looked at quite frequently, for example, at remote monitoring. So you have some sort of a gadget at home that measures some parameter of the patient, and hopefully you can identify the ones who are getting worse and do something to improve them. And one of my colleagues ran a trial of that here, or with some other centers. But I think it was relatively good at identifying the patients who were ill. The problem was it then took several weeks for anyone to do anything about that. You'd write to the GP who would say, well, I haven't got time to do anything for a while. I'll do something next week. I've got too much on. Or you would have, or we didn't have enough nurses to go and change something. So you could end up with a circumstance where you identify a problem, but as you can't change it for too long, it has no impact. It's too late by that stage. Either they've got worse already or they were okay. So you've got to put that innovation into a broader service that can absorb it, essentially. Again, you might give the example, mightn't you, of remote meetings, you know, Teams meetings, as we spend all our time doing now. We had that technology pre-pandemic, but no one was using it until we were suddenly forced to and to adapt our ways of working to bring that in. So it's having the receptive system, I suppose, and then also a service that can integrate that change usefully.
Yeah, I think you've brought up two very useful points there. One around the sort of matching the technology that's coming in or the innovation that's coming in with the needs on the front line and making sure that it does actually solve a problem that people are interested in solving and that can be absorbed by the service. And I think that's, in a sense, a long-term problem. You know, it's got to be solving a core problem for the frontline staff. I think then that other piece around when you bring something in, does it get adopted, is very interesting, because in a sense, there's a bit of a hump, isn't there? You know, whenever someone updates my computer and there's something new, then I get very frustrated because I can't immediately do the thing I want to do. I have to learn the new way of doing things, or I have to wait for something to update, or there's a bit of a delay in the process, in a sense. And I think working out how to kind of manage people's expectations and encourage people to embrace that change is really important, because if you don't, then it, even if it's a great thing that does actually solve a problem in the long term, it won't get adopted in the shorter term.
Yes, absolutely. And you see that in medicine, don't you, that things get, someone has a very good idea that could work and just no one takes it up for whatever reason.
So what would be your advice to people trying to bring new innovations into the NHS?
So I think talking to clinicians is one of the key bits. You get over that hump we spoke before of saying, is this actually useful? Could you actually genuinely integrate it into your service? I think that's one of the things. And I suppose another is being prepared to support people through that innovation a lot. And sometimes that's going to be financial or education or whatever you're going to do, so that you make an opportunity for the service to integrate it or the situation to integrate it. And I think so many bits of the hospital are now working at 95.5% the whole time that if you're asking people to do something new, it's so hard to find that capacity to do it. You know, most services have already been pushed as hard as we can push them, and that's just what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years, I think. So if you want to do something new, then you've got to find extra capacity for them from somewhere to integrate that new thing.
So you've obviously done quite a bit of digital and non-digital innovation in the past, James. Do you have anything else on the horizon? Any things that you're looking to potentially improve or change at the moment?
We talked a bit about virtual wards already, and I think there's a huge push from NHS England along this idea that virtual wards are the solution for apparently all sorts of problems. So we're trying to look into how that would work and how you can produce a safe and effective virtual model of doing what we would have otherwise done in hospital. So I think that's certainly a way of moving forward. And we're going to see more and more of that, I suspect. But the key bits there, I think, are coming down to the implementing it well, so that you can have something that's sustainable and safe, that's actually, you know, as good as what you would have done, or rather than being inferior or cut prices. That's the one of the risks of it.
Does in a way provide an opportunity, I think, to really reimagine the service, because it's so different to the way we do things at the moment.
You're right. I think that's so true. You know, that I suppose another thing we see so much of the time, isn't it, that we have something new and we bolt it onto what we're already doing, and it just gets stuck on the side, and you keep on bolting more bits onto the side, and that was something very unwieldy. And you're right. We so very rarely are able to go back and say, well, how would we like to do something in an ideal world? Of course, doing that whilst you're still going is a challenge. You know, how do you redesign the aeroplane in flight? It is an interesting challenge.
Yeah, and I think you do make a very good point that finding the bandwidth to engage with clinical staff is really challenging, but it's also hugely important for innovation and really essential to making sure that something is really solving a problem.
Yes, definitely.
James, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Really appreciate your time and your insights into cardiology.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been really interesting.
You've just been listening to James Gamble, consultant cardiologist, who talked about the challenges of managing large volumes of heart failure patients and the move towards virtual wards. I hope you enjoyed this latest in our series on opportunities for innovation on the front line of health and care. If this episode sparked some ideas, or you'd like to know more about The Hill and the work that we do, please reach out to the team on connect@thehilloxford.org. Visit our website, www.thehilloxford.org, or connect with myself or The Hill page on LinkedIn.